Okay, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, Michael P. from San Diego. Come on up, Michael. Let's do this. All right, buddy. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Michael Powers, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank South Bay Pioneers for inviting me to be here. And I've heard so much about this group and this facility. And I know people who have gotten sober through here. So for all the people who are volunteers or if you've been on the board, you know, thank you so much for continuing to do this. Day after day, year after year, and helping so many people get sober. My sobriety date is February 6, 1990. My home group is Mount Soledad Men's, and my sponsor is Joe C. And I was told when I got to AA that if I could make sure I always had those three things, I had a pretty good chance of staying sober. When I say I'm an alcoholic, it means I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know what that meant when I got here. The longer I'm around, the more I understand how it really is cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, that alcohol was a symptom of my disease. I still got a lot that I get to work on every single day. And thank you for helping me stay sober. I heard a guy say at a meeting one time that when he said he was an alcoholic, that meant given the choice between freedom and slavery, he would always unconsciously choose slavery and not know it. You know, that the bars, that the lock on the door was on the inside. I had to realize that I could open it anytime I was ready and ask for help, but I didn't know that. You know, what I know is that alcohol was a great pain reliever for me. I don't know that I was in a lot of pain growing up. I know that I was uncomfortable a lot. I didn't think I was self-centered. I thought I was maybe just a nice guy that drank a little too much. But what you've told me is that if I change that to self-conscious, it fits perfectly. I was always self-conscious. I was always worried about what you thought. And I was the last guy to get chosen for the sports. You know, I was a bookish kid. I was pretty uncoordinated. And, you know, so I always felt not good enough. And I've heard that story from a lot of people in AA. And nothing made that fear and that discomfort go away like when I took my first drink. And I heard a guy say, I don't remember my first drink of milk or my first drink of soda. I definitely remember my first drink of alcohol. It was Canadian Seagram 7 with 7-Up. And I was around this time of the year because high school football was over. It was like junior year. And we went to a party, and he got his older brother to get that whiskey. And we threw out half of the 7-Up and filled the rest of it with whiskey. And that buzz happened at the back of my head, and that little vibrating thing, you know, and I never felt that way ever. And like a lot of you, I got sick that night and then couldn't wait to do it again, you know, because of the way it made me feel. And that's what I did for the next, you know, within 5 years, I got to thinking about this, you know, I moved out, got a place with a bunch of guys that were going to college. I dropped out of college at the end of 4 years. They had a college degree. I had an addiction. And I was ready to do my first geographic because my relationships had already started going south. And what I know now, I used to feel a little embarrassed because I thought my story wasn't exciting enough compared to some of the, you know, war games that I heard from you guys. And I've had enough people come up and thank me afterwards to know that my story is my story, and I just have to tell it the way I tell it. My life got unmanageable really quickly because I was powerless over alcohol and other things. But my way of managing that, you know, at the end of 5 years of drinking was to get married at the age of 22. I married somebody and put her in charge of my life and said, here, you manage it, and I'm going to drink. And I thought that would work, and it kind of did for a while. But at some point, you know, your partner does get tired of being your mother, and you know, my life was totally unmanageable. So to make it really simple, I can say that I was married to one woman in my 20s and then married to another woman in my 30s. And both times I thought the problem was I wasn't married to the right person. I didn't realize I had a drinking problem, even though we fought constantly over my drinking. I always had a job. I thought, I can't be an alcoholic. I have a job. And I don't know why, you know, I always seem to be with people who want to boss me around and tell me what to do. And it's because I didn't know how to grow up and be responsible because I was too busy drinking. I mean, that's the honest truth. And so, you know, at the age of 37, actually, I had been dry for 3.5 years. I knew that because of a really bad hurricane episode, I was living in Florida at this time. Hurricanes are a good time to drink, by the way, if you live in Florida. It's a good excuse because everything's getting real crazy. And so, you know, that's always a good time for us. And so at the end of one really bad episode, she was ready to leave, and I said, you know, I went to a therapist, and the therapist said, write it out, like a wedding vow, in addition to your wedding vow, that if you ever drink again, it'll be like breaking your wedding vow. And I thought that sounded like a great idea. I'm a pretty good writer. So I wrote a real long one and signed it, and she took me back, and for 3.5 years, I didn't drink. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know about AA. I didn't know anything. And you know, like you've heard from other people, you know, I was white knuckling it. So it just didn't seem fair that everybody else could drink with impunity and I couldn't. So I wasn't happy about it. And I let everybody know that. And then I tried that experiment the book talks about and did a little controlled drinking. And, you know, the worst possible thing that happened that can happen to an alcoholic, nothing. Nothing. I took one or two beers. Two beers, that's my limit, and nothing happened. And so within, I'd say probably 4 weeks, I was putting away pretty good, most of a fifth of a vodka. And in Florida, I can tell you, you know, it's as good a place as any to drink, but if you're going to have vodka out in your trunk of your car, it's going to get really hot. And the only thing worse than hot vodka is no vodka. And but you got to stash it, you know, someplace. And I went through that for a while. And, you know, within 6 months, something really important happened this time that was really different. You know, I knew that my relationship, my marriage was not going well once again. This one was especially disturbing because I had two stepsons. And when I got in the picture, they were 3 years old and 7 years old. And when I left, they were 10 and 17. And I wasn't their full-time dad, but I was one of their dads. And I didn't know anything about raising children because I was pretty needy myself. And in fact, there was a fellow who came to our home group not too long ago who was newly sober and back in a relationship, and he said he was really having a hard time trying to love his children unconditionally because it felt like he was still babysitting. And I said, I know what you mean. Because I remember that feeling, the kids would come and want attention and want love. And I said it was like baby birds, like they were always going, feed me, feed me, feed me. And I always felt like I don't even have enough for me, much less you. You know, that's what drinking had done for me. Or maybe that's where I was and it just got worse, you know, because I wasn't growing up and I was just drinking. What I do know is that something really important happened. My wife at this time started going to Al-Anon. And I have to give credit to Al-Anon because I've heard a couple other people say this in meetings. If it hadn't been for Al-Anon, I probably would still be blaming her. You know, like it's all your fault. And what happened is because she went to Al-Anon is you know, all those buttons that had been installed somewhere along the line got, the wires were cut and it quit working. And I tried being sweet and I tried being angry. And, you know, I've learned since then that an alcoholic like me, when I start losing control in the relationship, I just want more control, you know, because I'm afraid of what's going to happen. And I didn't realize how much I depended on those people to help manage my life, to be honest with you, you know, until I finally, they were gone. You know, but I tried a few things, and then at some point she said, she started taking the boys to Alateen, and I could tell I was the control was slipping away, and I said, I don't remember giving my permission for that. And she said, I don't remember asking for your permission. And I knew the jig was up. I said, well, if it's going to be this way, maybe I should move out. And I figured that would do it. And she said, well, maybe you should. And called my bluff. So I had to move out. And I thought, you know, this new freedom, this will be good. And I was convinced that that was true. You know, just to tell you where I was at here in terms of my reality, like towards the end of my drinking, as a couple guys know, I was still only drinking beer as far as she knew, you know, and then grabbing the vodka on the side. I went away. She said, I think you've had enough to drink, right? That's a whole six pack. I said, yeah, you're right. This is the last one for tonight. And I went to throw it away under the sink where the trash can was, and that's where the vodka bottle was too. So I thought, well, you know, maybe one last chug. And I was like this with the vodka to my mouth. She came in and flipped the light switch up. And I looked right at her and I said, I know how this looks, but it's not what you think. And that was as honest as I could be at that time. And You know, so that was my game. And when I knew I had to move out, I moved out. And what I can tell you is that was in November. And this time of year always reminds me of that fact, to be honest with you, because, you know, going into the holidays, I had great expectations, I think a lot of us do, that this is going to be different or something's going to happen. And I know today that sometimes the best thing I can do is just say it's just one more day, and it doesn't matter what the rest of the world is doing on this day. It's just one more day. But we've heard there's things we can do, there's places we can go. And so if it's uneasy for you, I recommend, you know, to hang close, because that's what they said to me. I wasn't ready to get sober at the time. I went to my first AA meeting the day before Thanksgiving of that year. And really, be honest, she was going to Al-Anon. I thought if I went to AA, she might get impressed. I don't think I really wanted to go. And sometimes when you get those meetings right out of the schedule, you know, you don't really know where you're going to go. This, as I remember, it was seven older guys in the basement of a church in St. Petersburg, Florida, listening to the Big Book on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And when I said it was my first meeting ever, as you can imagine, their eyes opened really wide. And they invited me to come back, and I said, well, maybe I will. And but, you know, that was, I scooted out of there as quick as I could. Got through Thanksgiving, went to another meeting on the day after Thanksgiving, which was an Alano club in St. Petersburg, Florida. And, you know, it was mostly guys with leather and chains and their wallets and on the chains. And I thought, I don't know, saying the Lord's Prayer with these guys, I'm not sure this is my solution. But one guy really listened to me. He said, come on out, let's talk, what's going on? And I told him all the problems I was having with my marriage. And he said, I know how that feels. You know, I felt that way too. I've got this book, if you want it. And so I said, thank you very much. You know, he listened to me patiently for an hour. And I thought, well, this is different, you know, because people had gotten tired of hearing me whine about things and complain. And so I took the book home, but to be honest, we were pretending like things were still okay because the holidays weren't over. And the wife had said, when the holidays are up, that's it, that's the end of it. And so on New Year's Eve, I found myself sitting in my empty apartment, knowing that if I drank, because I had a couple of binges, you know, where I couldn't remember how I got home. And I already had one DUI. As a matter of fact, John, interesting, we changed the date to tonight. Exactly 41 years ago tonight, November 23rd, is when I got my DUI. I don't recommend drinking the day before Thanksgiving. The cops are really waiting for you there. It's kind of the kickoff for the season. And so that's how I got nabbed. I was in between marriages, and, you know, a lot of people were calling and telling me how much they didn't like me at that time. And so I drank quite a bit and got pulled over, got popped. But I knew what was going to happen if I started drinking again, you know. And I was at that place already that they talk about in the book, where I couldn't live with it and I couldn't live without it, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do next. And I think most of all, you know, for some of the guys that are in relationships or able to get sober, God bless you. For me, I had to realize, you know, that the Calvary wasn't coming. Like, nobody was coming. It was just me. And that's when I hit bottom. You know, I was sitting in an empty apartment, going to work, coming home, thinking about trying to not drink. And realizing that my life, you know, that I thought, if you'd asked me a few months earlier what my life was, I could reel off a whole bunch of stuff. And what I realized, it was just like a Hollywood set. It was just a cardboard, you know, you could just push it over, and there was nothing there. You know, I told my sponsor when I did a fourth and fifth step, I said, I feel like I was an emotional vampire on this other family. And it gave me the feeling that I had a life. And when they took the family away, when I had my familyectomy and it was just me, I realized how bogus that was, you know. It says in I think it's on page 73, this one really hit me. I do a daily meditation, and this one really jumped out. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents the stage character, his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. This is when we're supposed to do an inventory, you know, when we get ready to do a fifth step. That's what it says. And that was me, you know. I was keeping it together during the daytime, and then I'd go home and wonder, what am I doing? And so January was the longest month of my life. And on February 6th, I finally got into AA. And what I can tell you is that I think most of what I needed to know about staying sober, I learned that first year. You know, I was told later that we get 12 months as a gift. We get 12 months to do 12 steps. You can do them faster, but it's good to get them done during the 12 months because after that, you know, things can get a little harder. And, you know, one of the things that happened is I grew up in St. Louis, but I was living in Florida at the time. And when I was 90 days sober, I got word that my dad had passed away suddenly in St. Louis. And I had to go back for the funeral. And I'd had two really long conversations with him before that happened. And that was May 10th. In April, my soon-to-be ex-wife mentioned that she already had a boyfriend. And in June, it was Father's Day, and I told my sponsor at the time, I finally got a sponsor, and I said, I bet I don't get a Father's Day card. And he said, well, you know, and I'm thinking, well, actually, he wasn't much of a father, to be honest, but I always made sure that the boy's mother got a Mother's Day card. That day before Father's Day, I ran down to the mailbox to check, and sure enough, it was empty, and I couldn't wait to call her and let her know what a selfish person she was. And after about an hour of that, I finally hung up, or she hung up, I forget, but called my sponsor. And I'll always remember this because he said, well, I've just got two questions. First question is, why do you always call me second? And I stammered around and he said, nah, it's a rhetorical question. I know that you're without your kids and it's Father's Day and I know you're without your father. But did it ever occur to you, instead of going back to that same well that's been dry for so long, maybe you could have gone down to an Alano club, found a guy that was without his father, or maybe a father without his kids, or maybe just some guy who hadn't had anything to eat yet and said, hey, you want to go get a burger? How do you think you might have felt if you'd done that? And I said, probably better. And he said, well, this is really important, Michael, so let's remember this. You know, like you put a stake in the ground. We're going to go back to this, right? I want you to remember this. The next time you feel bad, instead of trying to find somebody that has what you need and trying to take it away from them, you can find somebody who needs what you have and give it away freely. And you will always feel better, and you will never need anybody else's permission to do that. And I said, I think that's a great idea, Art. And he said, well, good, because that's 180 degrees from the way you've been doing it up till now. Like, that's really practicing the opposite. And I always have to say, to be total honesty, a year later, I was at a noon meeting in Pinellas Park, Florida, and it was Father's Day, and I told that story because it was Father's Day, and a guy came up afterwards who was missing some teeth, and he said, thank you so much for telling that story. And I said, have you had anything to eat yet today? And he said, not really, no. I said, do you want to go get a burger? And so we went down the street. And he proceeded to tell me how my life could have turned out because he had a master's degree. He had three kids. If I'd kept drinking, he was missing teeth. He'd been homeless for 2 years. That's how my story would have turned out. For the price of a burger, I got to see how my life could have been if I hadn't gotten into AA when I did. And so that thing about giving it away when I feel bad, that's really when I don't want to give it away, is when I feel bad. But what you guys have taught me is that's absolutely what I have to do. As I heard one guy say, when I think I need a drink, I really need a drunk. I need to find somebody. And just calling a guy up and saying, how's your day going, right? And that's what you've taught me. So that was early in my first year of sobriety, you know, already. And my sponsor said, I went to my sponsor and I said, I think I should do a four-step. You know, I'm hearing it's getting to be time. And he said, well, then let's do a four-step. I said, but I'm not sure I'm ready. He said, well, then let's not do a four-step. I said, but I'm afraid I'm going to, you know, drink. And he said, well, then let's do it. I said, but I'm really busy working. Well, then let's not do it. And I said, Art, I don't understand. Should I do it or should I not do it? And he said, yes. Do it or don't do it, but quit talking about it. Quit whining about it because that doesn't do any good. A few months later, the business I was working at, it was a magazine, went out of business. And just between you and me, that was the first time I'd ever been without another paycheck because there was always somebody else who was bringing in a paycheck when I was not working. This is the time I lost my job and there was no paycheck. And I started going to two meetings a day, you know, noon meeting and then an evening meeting, my regular meeting. I did 90 meetings in 90 days, like you guys suggested, because I didn't really have a lot going on in the evenings. So it might as well, you know. Weekends were really tough because I had more time on my hands. But I kind of followed you from meeting to meeting like a little puppy. I was given guys' rides to meetings early on, and that was very helpful because I was worried about those guys getting drunk if I didn't pick them up. I'd come home from work, I'd be ready to just, you know, take a nap or something. And I said, I don't want that guy to drink. So I'd go pick him up, and that guy never did stay sober, but I did. I finally called my sponsor and said I lost my job, and I have time to do my fourth step now. He said, yeah, well, that problem's been removed. You know, you can do it now. And I was really afraid. So I started working on my fourth step. And what I know is that at that same meeting, there was a guy there. When I confessed, you know, it was a meeting on fear. I think the topic was fear. And I said, that's been a problem for me lately. And this guy who'd been around for a little while, his name was Fireman Norm. And he said, have you tried praying? And I said, well, I thought about it. And he said, only alcoholics get confused between actually doing something and thinking about it. He said, did thinking about eating ever satisfy your hunger? I said, no, not really. He said, yeah, we have to really do it. And I said, well, you know, praying is not a thing I've really been real comfortable with. And you know, he said, I got a story for you. And Fireman Norm said he came from Boston, and he was a fireman. That's how he got the name. And the firemen, they're like, they're on for 3 days, and then they're off for 2 days. And so the 3 days they're on, they live at the bunkhouse. They live at the firehouse. And he said he would say his prayers when he was at home by himself, but when he was at the firehouse, he was embarrassed. He didn't want the guys to laugh at him, you know, kneeling down next to his bunk. And his sponsor said, you know, Norm, you're in a very dangerous job. You're going to have to either hit your knees or you're going to hit the bottle. Like, those are your choices at some point, because what you do is dangerous, and it's scary. And so after one really bad three-alarm fire, and they all came back and were putting their stuff away, and Norm said he was shaking, and he knew that he would have to hit his knees and say a prayer. And so he kind of made up his mind to do it, and he knelt down, and he said if anybody laughed, he's going to jump up and hit them. But he said he knelt down, he waited till it got quiet. He thought the coast was clear. And he got up to get back, and he said his prayers. He got back, you know, thank you, God, for saving my life today. Keep me so safe and alcohol-free. And he looked around, and all the other guys were next to their bunks saying their prayers too. And he said that's when he realized that staying sober really wasn't about him. You know, it was like doing the next indicated thing, not knowing who it was going to affect. And funny thing about Fireman Norm, you know, I told that story after I moved to California, and there was a new guy there, only been sober a little about a year, who was in the Navy, came up afterwards, and he said, my dad lives in Clearwater, Florida. Fireman Norm is his sponsor. I know who Fireman Norm is. He goes, my dad's a fireman, and he has Fireman Norm as a sponsor. And then he put me in touch with his dad, and his dad put me in touch with Norm. And they let me know when Norm passed away. It was probably about 10 years ago now. But, you know, what are the odds, right? What are the odds? How this goes full circle. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that was like the first year. And I did manage to finally do my fifth step. Around this time, Thanksgiving, there was a guy that showed up at our meetings who had been sober 18 years and then relapsed. And he had been on a merchant marine ship. He was a cook. His name was John the cook, and he had relapsed, and his story was that he had let go of his, he had given this guy a whole bunch of his money to invest, and the guy had lost all the money. It was John's life savings, and he said he'd forgiven God for it, but he'd forgiven the guy for it, but he hadn't forgiven God for letting it happen. That was his story, and he said, I know without this conscious contact, I'm never going to be able to stay sober. And I need to let go of this resentment against God. And that was John's story. I was pretty new, you know, and I thought, well, I hadn't felt that connection yet. You know, it wasn't really that strong. But he said, no, I knew when I lost it that it was gone. He said, it's just like if you're in the sunlight and a cloud comes over and the sun's gone. And he said that's how it felt when he lost his conscious contact with his higher power. And he went, he had the hardest time staying sober. There was a bunch of us that year, because it was the first year of, you know, being sober. We were all away from our families, and a bunch of people said, let's get together and get a turkey, and let's just, all of us orphans, we'll celebrate Thanksgiving in, you know, somebody's house. And they said to John, John, can you cook a turkey? Well, yeah. Well, we'd really appreciate it if you would come help us do this turkey, because a lot of us are kind of young. We've never done all that, and we don't know how to do it. Well, John was in his element. You know, I took pictures of, I still have pictures of John fixing up that turkey, and he was so happy. And it was honestly one of the best turkeys I've ever eaten. And it was the first time, you know, where these are a whole bunch of strangers, not really. These are folks we know in the meeting. And I was just made welcome, you know, and be a part of. And watched this guy just gleaming, you know. And unfortunately, John didn't stay sober. And on New Year's Eve of that year, John died. He burned up in a fire because he passed out when he's smoking in his apartment. And then it was like 2 or 3 days into the next year, somebody said, did you hear what happened to John? And that was the first time I knew this disease kills people. Like, holy crap. Like, this is the guy. This is the guy that cooked my Thanksgiving dinner, and he's gone. And it just brought it right home to me, right? Like, this is the difference. While I was out of work there, I was pretty scared, and I was saying the prayers as the guys told me to do. But, you know, during the holidays, kind of tough time to find another job. And, you know, slowly but surely, I guess my sponsor said, it's not your job to find a job, it's your job to look for a job. God will find you a job. You just got to look. You just got to do the footwork. We stay out of the results. That's what I was told. So I just tried to do it that way. And slowly but surely, things got better. I remember being in a meeting, and a woman who'd been sober for a long time, you know, said, what's the matter, honey? And I said, well, I don't have a job. She said, honey, are you in AA? And I said, I think so. And she said, well, you always have a job if you're in AA, because our job is to stay sober and help other people stay sober. And if you do a good job of that, God will make sure you always have a roof over your head and you always have enough to eat. So stay sober first, and everything else will work out. And so I tried to just follow that example. I was really fortunate. I feel like I landed with a bunch of people for whom AA was not a place they went. It was a way of life that they lived. And I didn't have that much of a life to start with, you know. It was the first time ever, really, that I had been on my own. And I was 37 years old. And I really didn't ever want to feel that way again. And that's what got me in here with you guys. It was time to grow up. After about 4 years, my sponsor decided he was going to move. He had grown up in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is where everybody retires. But he said, if you grow up there, you have to move someplace else when you retire. So he turned 65 and he moved to North Carolina. And I kind of felt, you know, betrayed. But I was done with Florida, and I was kind of done with the job I had, and I was, you know, I hear later people hit sometimes to get a 5-year plateau, and things, you know, the chaos goes away. And I felt like I wasn't really growing, and I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to do. And I was back in St. Louis visiting my little brother, who had just built a brand new house, had 2 kids getting ready to go to college, been married to a flight attendant at American Airlines for years, worked for American Airlines. And I was whining to him about how my life was so crappy and his was so wonderful. And I was the oldest, and how did this happen? And he looked right at me and he said, yeah, but you also don't have anybody telling you what to do. You don't have to worry about college tuition or mortgage. You're not stuck in a job that you've had for 35 years. Whose permission are you waiting for? If you need to go do something, why don't you just go do it? And I think my sponsor would have said that if he'd still been around, but my brother told me instead. There was a nonprofit here in San Diego that I had been doing work for a long distance trying to help out. And my brother said, you always get excited when you talk about that nonprofit. Why don't you go check that out in San Diego? Because I said, I don't know where I want to go. You know, I'm done with Florida. I don't want to move to St. Louis. The Midwest is kind of, check out San Diego. I said, I've never been to San Diego. I don't know a damn thing about San Diego. He said, we saw tickets at the airport. Anybody can go. You just buy a ticket. And it was, Yeah, I mean, it's obvious now, but at the time, that was really amazing. And so I did. I remember calling the nonprofit guy, and I said, if I got out there, I could help you, right? I mean, he says, we don't have any money for that. And I said, no, I'll get a job doing something else. But, I mean, I could volunteer, and I could help you. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, so that was September or October, I think, of 94. By January of 95, I was here. I started getting the newspaper delivered. On Wednesday, I'd get the Sunday paper. That's how long ago that was. And applying for jobs. And I got hired over Christmas holidays. And I threw all my stuff in the car and drove here. It takes 3 days to get here from St. Petersburg, if you want to know that. Like, if you don't stop much. St. Pete to Beaumont's one day. Beaumont, Texas to El Paso is a whole nother day. Big state. Yeah. And I managed to get in here late on Wednesday evening. I went to Claremont Men's on Thursday. And then Soledad, I was invited to go to Soledad on Saturday. And the one thing that had been missing in my life was a group of guys that I could hang out with. And I don't know if, I don't think there were men's meetings in Florida, in St. Petersburg. I don't think they ever did that. I know if they did, I wouldn't have been interested because that was not where I was comfortable. But when I got here, I just was surrounded by guys who would help me know where to go next. And for a whole year, basically, I just hung out with these guys and got to know them, went to retreats, you know, did all the stuff, and really felt part of. And it really helped me grow up a lot. And found people in the, you know, older guys who are like my surrogate father and people that I could really depend on. And got to be comfortable in my own skin finally, you know, just being myself. And then after a year, my sponsor, Dave Moore, said, well, it's time to get back on the horse. And I said, you know, I'm comfortable, Dave. I've never really been good at the relationship thing. He said, alcoholics don't really have relationships. We have arrangements. It's kind of a quid pro quo thing. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. He said, that's not what a relationship is. A relationship, you're either 100% in or you're 100% out. If you still have one foot on the floor, they can tell. You know, like you have to be in or out. And sometimes you're not going to get your back scratched, and you still have to give 100% anyway. It doesn't matter. And I kind of had learned how that was from hanging out with guys. You know, I'm either all the way in or I'm all the way out. I made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of a higher power. It was a decision to be in a relationship with a power greater than me. It wasn't a quid pro quo thing. It wasn't an arrangement. You know, I come to find out my higher power was always there, ready to help. I was the one that didn't want to ask for any help. So, you know, learning how to be in a relationship was something really new for me. And Dave kept pushing me, you know, he says, what are you afraid of? You know, sobriety is about walking through your fears. And I said, what am I afraid of? He said, it's just dating. I said, Dave, I don't date. I take hostages, really. That's been my history. And he said, well, sobriety is about doing the opposite of what you always did. And he kind of pushed me, and he instructed me, and I just say this if anybody's in this position, if you're single and you're wondering how to date, his advice was, he said, what do you do? I said, well, I ask her out, and then, okay, she says yes, then what? Where do you want to go? Oh, that's completely wrong. That's absolutely wrong. Okay, Dave, how are we supposed to do it? He says, what do you like to do? I said, I don't know, baseball game. Buy two tickets to the baseball game. Say, you see somebody you want to meet, you just say, I've got two tickets to the Padres game, would you like to go? If they say no, you ask somebody else. If they say no, you ask somebody else. Eventually, somebody will say yes. You go to the Padres game, you say, thank you very much. It was a great evening. You take her home, that's it. You don't get her phone number, you don't pick out China, you don't move in, any of that. Then you ask somebody else out, what else do you like to do? Oh, I got La Jolla Playhouse tickets. Oh, yeah, that'd be good. La Jolla Playhouse, get tickets to the play. Two tickets, you want to go? He says, do that for 6 months. One date with different people. He said, you're just doing research because you don't know what kind of person you'd even like to be with. That was one of the hardest things I've ever done, but I didn't want to fall back into the trap that I'd been with before, and so I followed his instructions. Slowly but surely, it got easier. And then after about 5 or 6 months, and, you know, you hear a lot of advice in the meantime. Like, I'm only going to be able to be in a relationship with somebody about as well as me. You know, so the weller I am, the weller the relationship is going to probably be. If you want to meet the right woman, be the right man, all that stuff turns out to be true. And so I did that. And after about 5 months, I think it was Memorial Day, I was at a party with all single people, men and women, and I met this woman who was really attractive and really interesting. And I used to work for a newspaper, and she used to work for TV news. And so we had that in common, the whole journalism thing. And then we said, it's a mixer. We should probably be mixing, right? You know, so thank you. You're really nice, but let's talk to some other people. And then about a half an hour later, I was getting something out of my car, and she was out there smoking a cigarette. She goes, you're the one person I didn't want to see me smoking like this. And then we talked about our addictions. And she was getting ready to go to a ministerial thing. Turned out she had a spiritual program. And I said, well, all I know about God is what I've heard in AA, to be honest with you. Oh, you're in AA. You're in recovery. So we got that out of the way. One thing led to another. But, I mean, this December, it'll be 26 years. Right, honey? Yeah. And I just say that, you know, because I am trying to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And, you know, the truth is, I think we agree we met each other at just the right moment. If we'd met each other any sooner, I don't know that it would have worked out, you know, because I wasn't ready for somebody as intelligent as that. And I didn't think I deserved it. A lot of the lessons I think that we've learned from each other in the meantime has been amazing. I want to say, at Claremont Men's, I heard a guy say one time, this is when I was still being single, not dating and anything, that he said he and his wife had been married 10 years and they had never raised their voices to each other once. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, Lloyd, that thank you for saying that. I'm sure that was an exaggeration, but that sounds wonderful. And he said, no, I mean, we get angry with each other, but I respect my wife too much to raise my voice to her. And I really did. I walked away. I thought, wow, what would that be like? Like, I hadn't even imagined anything like that. And, you know, sometimes you have to be able to imagine something before you can see it when it shows up, I guess, is kind of that. That was the lesson on that, is what you guys really were able to do. I mean, what I've learned since that time is it's really hard to get sober for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is you're getting something that's really important you're giving up, and we don't know what's going to take the place of that thing. And so what we try to do at meetings is, you know, help paint that picture of what life could be like if I was willing to give up my painkiller. You know, the thing that I've really been focusing on lately, I have to say, you know, the work never quits. It says in our 12 and 12 that under Chapter 4, I think it is, under Step 4, it says, it's in our relationships we're the sickest, because we either try to dominate people or we depend on them far too much. And so being out of, being in a relationship which is scary. And so it requires this sort of constant making a decision. As I remember, early in the relationship, we were trying to decide whether to move in together. And one of us said, it probably doesn't matter what you want, or what God, it doesn't matter what you want, doesn't matter what I want. What matters is what does God want, because God always gets his way. And I thought, well, on that basis, I could go further and keep going on this thing, you know what I mean? In a relationship, there's three parties. There's me and there's my wife, and then there's a higher power. And even if you don't want to accept the higher power part, there's me and my wife, and then there's the relationship. And sometimes it doesn't matter what I want or what she wants. It matters what does the relationship want. Because when you're in that decision, you know, that's the next big important question. And, you know, my wife doesn't usually come to these talks, which is good because she's a minister and she gives talks other places that I don't go to, so that's fair. But this is a kind of a big deal, so she wanted to come here tonight, and I appreciate that she's here. There are times when I got most of my lessons in that way, because I worked 6 years at a really good business here. And after 6 years, I was let go because they were downsizing. And, you know, when you get that announcement, they put your stuff in a box and you're walked out to the car at 10 in the morning. And that happened, and I was really stunned. I didn't see it coming. I called my sponsor first, and I said, I just got laid off after 6 years. And I need to tell my wife. And he said, well, don't call her. He said, you don't want to deliver that kind of news in, you know, over the phone. I said, well, she doesn't get home till like 6 o'clock tonight, 5:30 or 6. And he goes, what are you going to do in the meantime? I said, I don't know. And he said, well, come on over here. So we hung out during the day. And then when it was like 5 o'clock, 5:30, I came home. And I walked in and I said, honey, I'm sorry to give you this news, but I got laid off today. I'm out of work. And she looked right at me. She said, well, that's great. Let's go celebrate. And I said, why? She goes, because something better is getting ready to come along. And a month later, something did. I mean, I got a call from some guys who flew in to interview me and wanted to set up a business with the company that I used to work for. And I was the inside guy. But we didn't know that at the time, but I didn't need to know it, and she didn't need to know it. She just said, something better is going to come along. And I said, well, where do you think the money's going to come from in the meantime? And she said, well, from wherever it is right now. And I watched her kind of go through that, you know, when she wanted to go to ministerial school, but it was going to be kind of expensive. And then about 2 weeks later, she found out, oh, yeah, when that she was working with NBC, there was a pension that she didn't know about. And they just announced it. And guess what? It was exactly the right amount to cover the thing. So, you know, this whole thing about trusting in a higher power, my sponsor likes to remind me, you know, that if I'm still trying to figure everything out, I'm not living in faith. And so, you know, my job is to do the next indicated thing and trust that whatever's supposed to happen will happen. This time of year especially, you know, it's just a good reminder. When I think about, I got to lead a retreat 3 weeks ago, the men's retreat, and we talked a lot about some of this stuff. I drank because I was in pain. And you know what? I've been sober for a while, but I still get uncomfortable. I still have pain. And all I was ever looking for was relief. And if I can't turn to any chemicals for relief, I have to find relief someplace else. And you know what you guys have taught me through these steps is that these are spiritual exercises that if I do them on a regular basis, I'll get stronger spiritually and I'll get relief. And I'll have some way of getting out of that pain that I always found myself in. And I think I heard it a couple of weeks ago that, you know, AA does slowly and sustainably what alcohol used to do quickly and very short term. But I have to be patient enough to let it work. Guy said, doing these spiritual exercises, he says, going to a 12-step program and not doing the 12 steps is a little bit like going to the gym and not ever working out, just watching other people work out. Not only do you not get stronger, but it's a little creepy. Eventually, they'll ask you to leave. Thank you. So this time of year especially, it's like what you guys have taught me is that, and I'm trying to be reminded of this on a daily basis, that whenever I'm grateful or I do the gratitude list, I have so much to be grateful for. Just being able to give a talk like this, I can really remind myself how much AA has given to me and how much I have to be grateful for today. But I never felt that way when I got here. You know, I felt like I was entitled to so much more than what I was getting. You know, and so what I understand today is that just like, you know, the opposite of pain is relief, the opposite of entitlement is gratitude. Entitlement is the enemy of gratitude. You know, if I think I'm entitled to a bunch of stuff, if I come in here and start thinking about all the things that I should have got, that I didn't get, I'm in trouble quickly. You know, instead, you guys have taught me that I can pray and be grateful for what I've got today in my life and all the things I don't have in my life that were removed that I didn't really need. You know, and to learn to be grateful and give back as often as I can, because that's what you do with a gift, is you give it back and you pass it on. Thanks for helping me stay sober tonight, guys.
Michael, thank you very much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. We really appreciate it. Please come back and share with us again. And one more time for Michael. Thank you to the Women of Auxiliary and the Men of the House for a great dinner tonight. And be sure and get your goodies before they're all gone. Let's circle up.